So we're going to yak about your latest stuff, your New York Times Weekly that just finished up, and the recollection of Love and Rockets in the smaller manga size, and some history in Love and Rockets.
Alrighty.
I guess first, thanks for coming on the show. This is CITR 101.9 FM. We are joined by Jaime Hernandez, one of the Los Bros Hernandez from Love and Rockets. Now, pronounce your name properly.
Jaime.
Jaime. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm very white. That's my excuse.
That's okay. You can't help it.
I can't. I try. So coming, I think it's first book coming out in January of the new Love and Rockets Recollecting.
You know what? You probably know more about this than I do. I'm just, you know, I'm helping put it together. But as far as dates and things like that, I'm still kind of in the dark.
So
you tell me.
I think it's coming in January. I think that's what the rep I deal with from one of the book distributors was telling me. So why the choice to recollect it in the smaller format?
I think that's... I don't know, maybe it's different. It's probably keeping up with the formats that are, should I say, in, you know, right now. You know, I'm not a big whiz at marketing or anything like that. So I leave that up to other people, and they say, "What do you think of a smaller size?" I go, "Well, if you say so, it must be right."
You just worry about the artwork and let someone else worry about the process.
Yeah, and I imagine it's because of what's the size right now, you know.
Okay. So you just finished up a run on the New York Times Funny Bite Pages, is that what they're calling it?
Yeah.
Which was a story in itself. It was a kind of a different story for your storytelling techniques, because it wasn't so much... it was just internal dialogue of Maggie going to go visit Rena on her mystery island.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of... tried to think of many different ways to do it, and I tried to think of many different characters to use, and I tried to think of a character that didn't cuss as much as the others, because I kind of didn't want to compromise the material, but at the same time I knew, you know, what I was up against in the New York Times, and so I thought, well, Maggie can hold her tongue every once in a while, and when I put Maggie in something, she can work amongst anybody, you know, any situation. So also because when I was younger and I used to get jobs that were for a wider audience, meaning an audience that didn't know what the hell my stuff was about, I used to just agonize and say, what does Joe Every Guy think or want or like, you know? And then I just said, forget it. They hired me, so they get what I do, you know? But I still couldn't get that nagging part that this was a new audience and mostly people who didn't even read comics, you know, so it was kind of a juggling act.
A unique chance for exposure.
Well, they don't normally carry comics in that paper, do they?
No, it was the Sunday specials that started out with Chris Ware did a building strip, and then you followed up with your strip, and now I think Seth is doing
one now. They were gonna take a couple of weeks break or something like that. I don't know. Is his out yet?
I think he has two out now.
Oh.
So it was a really neat story, because it's a story in itself that you could read on your own, but it was a bit of an epilogue for Rena. Was that kind of purposeful? Is like kind of finishing her story, or is there more to come?
And in a way, I just kind of tried to do this. kind of, legendary figure in the world, that, and just showing how a person with an exciting background really lives, which they don't do anything, you know. I don't know. At first, this was going to be told through Rena's eyes, and then it didn't read so colorful because she just doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
That's why I needed Maggie.
To get that impact of just, you know, how someone's gone from being, you know, the adventurer of the world to tending her garden.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what is it about Maggie that is such an enduring character for you?
I can put her in more situations than I can any of the other characters, and she's just a person who deals with it, you know. Another person would say, "Screw this," and you know, finish the story. You know, Maggie, she runs with it, you know, and she'll take whatever they give her, whether she likes it or not, you know, she will. And there's always something in her that makes her care, you know, and which makes her kind of a sucker, you know. So I love throwing her into situations.
Just seeing what she...
You know.
Now, in that story, it's her 40th birthday. And I didn't realize that she'd gotten to that age, the character. I thought that was neat, because Love and Rockets, is it almost 25 years now that you've been doing the book?
Yeah.
So she's almost going to real time, because she's like, I don't remember how old her character was when you first started, but she was a young whippersnapper.
Yeah, and this story is actually happening a year or two ago, because she would, if the time is realistic, she would be in her early 40s. You know, I just wanted to do the big 40 thing, because that's usually a birthday that that kills people, you know, when they reach there.
It's the impact.
So that would be a little more exciting than if she said, "Today I turned 42.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about doing real time? Like, what is it about that aspect that you like to go with? Because it's a lot of people just kind of deal with their universe of comics and kind of pick a time frame and just deal with that. But you've kind of like it seems like you've grown with the art style, with the book, with the characters developing maturely too.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard doing the real time, because I'm much slower than real time, you know. So I have to jump ahead 2 years every once in a while. There was a point where I wanted to forget real time and just not worry about it, but there's always something that comes up that has to bring them to the present. And drives me nuts sometimes, but I don't know. It's just the thing of I just think when the more people age, the more it means when you look back at when they were teenagers. You know, just a sentimental feeling. You know, kind of.
Well, it must have been tempting just to, you know, leave them in their sort of punk rock world forever.
Yeah, but you know, I found that it was very exciting and very challenging to take them out of that and just see how they deal with it and stuff like that. You know, it's kind of exciting to see, you know, where are they going to go next, kind of thing. You know,
one thing with the early Love and Rockets is there was a big sci-fi element to it, which has since thoroughly dissipated, I guess. And is there any chance of revisiting sci-fi concepts?
Oh, sure. But it would be only particular characters. You know, it's I don't see Maggie going back into space, you know, time in the near future, just because of where her position in the comics and what's what allows her, you know, to be.
Penny Century seems to live a rather bizarre life.
Yeah, that's what her character's made for, you know, where I can take her anywhere and I don't have to apologize for it. it doesn't make the story suffer. You know, it depends on how the characters fit into the universe, how much they're allowed to escape the universe, you know, and then which ones are trapped in it, you know, that kind of thing.
The sexuality of the characters, was it kind of, do you feel like it's important to kind of get that element of like that full-bodied, I guess, is that the right word I'm looking for with Maggie, the full-bodied Latino character, to kind of avoid stereotypes, or?
Yeah, it's hard to explain, but it's more because I like to see them, how far they can go into the real world, you know, making Maggie that way just felt right more than I felt like I was doing something politically correct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, I got my cake and eat it too. You know, it just makes the universe, you know, larger. The more I do that, the more I show people on the street kind of thing, you know. I have the weakness for the glamour, curvy glamour girls. But at the same time, I just really excites me to try to put them as close to the real world as I can. It helps the stories. It helps just helps make their world worth it for me, you know.
I remember when Maggie put on weight in the comic, it created quite a stir at the time.
Yeah, which surprised me. I remember, getting hate letters.
Hate letters.
And then people saying things like, you know, like, so is everyone going to get fat? You know, one fat character in the whole history of comics, and you guys are crying, you know. I found out what a lot of my readers were made of. You know, they wanted Penny Century.
Well, it seemed like the Maggie and Hopi characters in particular became so iconic for a generation of punk rock people that they felt a sense of ownership on your characters.
Yeah, I kind of sensed that a lot. So, you know, that sometimes made me say, how can I twist this? You know, how can I stir things up? You know.
Well, I think that's kind of ironic because since then, more full-bodied female characters have become very much the norm and a standard for people, especially more in the comic community with people like Strangers in Paradise and stuff like that. So you've started something and changed it, I guess.
Right, I guess. You know, you know, the funny thing to me is that it's not that hard. You know,
no.
Maybe it's just not that hard for me, but I don't know.
I find it odd, too, because, you know, majority of people aren't skinny. The mass majority of people. So when people get upset that one person isn't skinny anymore.
Yeah, you know, I think it's because they don't want to be fat. Or something, you know, or I don't know, it's just that ideal, you know, of the perfect body kind of thing. And it's, I don't know, it's just a bigger problem than we think, you know.
Well, I remember looking at, I think, John Byrne comics and all the villains, like the incredible villains who were all immensely fat in one of his comics.
Right, but they had to be villains.
Yeah. Yep.
But Byrne's a fat guy himself, too, so.
Self-loathing.
There we go. More of the comic self-loathing.
Down the street the dogs are barking, and the days are getting dark. As the night comes in, madness shatters from the sounds inside my mind. I know there's one too many mornings. One too many mornings, yes sir. One too many mornings since you're gone. Since you're gone. From the crossroads of my doorstep, my eyes start to fade. As I turn my head back to the room where my love and I have stayed. Yes, and I gaze back to the street, all the sidewalks and the sand. I know there's one too many mornings. One too many mornings, yes sir. One too many mornings since you're gone. Since you're gone. Now it's a restless, hungry feeling that don't mean no one no good. Yes, one and everything that I'm saying, you could say it just as good. Well, you're right from your side, yes, but I'm right from mine. We know there's one too many mornings. One too many mornings. One too many mornings since you're gone. Hey, since you're gone.
Another prominent thing, which I really appreciate in your comic, is poverty. It's an issue that, like, the characters really face a lot, especially Maggie deals with. And it's not really touched upon in a lot of other comics, but it is something a lot of people really deal with heavily.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be a something, an issue that that most comics want to deal with because it gets in the way. I don't know. Or just that's not what they're interested in. You know, they're interested in confrontation and the going, you know, to the fight, you know, or something. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I was, it's stuff around me, you know, and I used stuff around me because I'm too lazy to research or something. Yeah.
So what was that really got you into comics as a young feller?
I just loved them. I mean, it was just that was just our world, you know, in the world of my family, my four brothers and one sister. It was just something we did. I mean, it came from that my mom was a comic fan in the 40s and 50s, and Mario was encouraged to buy them, my oldest brother Mario, And then it was just something you did, like watch TV or ride a bike. You know, it just seemed like the normal thing. I didn't know it was geeky till later. Kids at school told me it was. You know, so I've never had a self-loathing doing this stuff. You know, I've never felt guilty doing my characters, doing comics, or even doing superheroes in the comic. You know, I never felt like I had to hide. You know, I hide it or something. You know,
it just felt like right to the story that you're doing.
Yeah, yeah, and growing up, you know, getting into rock and roll and stuff like that, and getting into being into monster movies and all that fun stuff. I just had this feeling that comics went alongside it, you know. And then some rock star would, you know, write a little in the lyrics. You know, you'd mention some comic book reference. And it just, like, fit, you know. It just, you know, the guitar player for New York Dolls, Johnny Thunder. I mean, where do you get that?
I don't know.
The comic Johnny Thunder?
Oh, I didn't know there was a comic called Johnny Thunder.
Isn't it? Wasn't Johnny Thunder?
Johnny Thunder was a DC character from the 60s.
Oh.
I mean, his name was Johnny Thunders, but
it was there.
Yeah. And, you know, just all that stuff just seemed to go together to me. And rock and roll was okay. You know, you were cool if you were into rock and roll. Well, rock and rollers were into comics, so comics are cool.
They were Ramones.
They were into monster movies, so monster movies are cool. You know, it's just something that I always thought just was okay. You know, and I still think it's okay. I don't apologize for it ever.
So, you were reading Peanuts?
Peanuts?
Peanuts the Strip, you were reading that?
Oh, yeah.
And I understand someone that doesn't get mentioned a lot is Hank Ketchum. I understand you're a fan of his work?
Yeah, and I was also a fan of his ghost artists that did the comic books.
Oh.
They happened to be very good artists.
He did Dennis the Menace.
Yeah. I know who he is called.
The listeners might
know. I always liked that stuff because they had such a natural way of drawing where it looked like people were, how people stood, how people, their posture, you know, and stuff like that. And I just, I was a big fan of Jack Kirby, but I was also a big fan of this because of the naturalism in it, you know. And there was a lot of naturalism in Kirby too that a lot of people never mention. And anything that just brought me closer to the way humans are, you know, just really interested me. And in drawing, if you could capture a human gesture in a few lines, that was wonderful, you know. And so that's what I've been trying to do all these years.
Did you see any comics from outside the United States, Europe or Mexico? Or
not many came over till Heavy Metal magazine, you know. So I didn't know a lot of the stuff early on. I knew who Tintin was, you know, but I didn't exactly, the stuff wasn't really that available here in the States, you know. You know, I got into Mobius when the Heavy Metal came and stuff like that, and there wasn't that many Mexican comics out. I remember that one Memeen, the one about the kid who looks like a monkey. It was a big controversy when they wanted to put him on a stamp.
Oh, yes, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, and but not that much European stuff till I got older, until I was doing Love and Rockets already.
Now, punk rock was a big influence for you in your early stuff. What kind of role did it play? Like the work of Pettibone.
Punk rock was just my my calling. You know, I was 18 years old, and there was this thing that was going to free me from high school. You know, high school was just zero, nothing. You know, and I graduated high school, and punk was already going on, but I didn't really discover it till after high school. And it was just that thing that, you know, somebody has their big change when they go to college. You know, some people do it when they get their job or something. You know, there's something that just changes them or doesn't change them or punk was just the thing that just opened my eyes again and reminded me of why I'm here. You know, because high school sure didn't. and it was exciting. And it was along the lines of what I was saying earlier, rock and roll, comics, just all the wonderful, stupid stuff that...
Wrestling?
I'm sorry, what?
Wrestling?
Wrestling was there, too.
Well, was that a big part of your life? Or?
Well, sure, it was... It kind of fit with all that stuff for me. It was just all this wonderful just entertainment that was just so, just this quirky, I don't know how to explain it, just really cool stuff that just kind of worked for me, you know, just a very big entertaining part of my life, you know.
And this was the L.A. punk scene with, like, Black Flag and...
Yeah, and I was lucky to be in it early enough where it was, how the kids say, raw and real. You know? and Black Flag X, even the Go-Go's were considered a punk band, you know. It was just a guess, you know. It was driving to L.A. and going to see shows, and it was just all... I guess it was the first time I was ever involved in a kind of revolution, you know, being there, watching it instead of on TV, you know.
And, were you ever in a band?
What's that?
Were you ever in a band?
Sure. I was always in garage bands. Never went that far with them. There was a point where all the local bands in our town were starting to record, you know, on some really tiny labels, and Gilbert and I were in a band together, and we had to decide if we were going to be cartoonists or rock stars. And we thought, well, we're better cartoonists than we are musicians, so we never got to go that far with it.
Now, how from at that point, I guess you guys started self-publishing Love and Rockets.
We did the first one by ourselves.
The first one by ourselves, and that was the three of you with Mario.
Yeah, Mario came to us and said he knew somebody who could get us some cheap printing, and he said, "Why don't we put a comic together?" And Gilbert and I said, "Okay." You know, I didn't know where my comic career was going. I wanted to draw them, but I didn't know for who, you know. And he came up with that idea, and we thought, oh, that'd be cool, like those old fanzines from the 70s, you know, those comic fanzines. And and so we got it printed, and we kind of just... We stapled one together and kind of just stared at it and said, "Now what?" You know. And it wasn't long after that when Fantagraphics picked us up.
Wasn't it?
So we didn't really have a chance to fail.
Wasn't it first known as Love Rockets?
What's that?
Well, the title, was it Love and Rockets from the beginning, or?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a black and white copy that's floating out there. I see it every once in a while.
How did
it? It was pretty much the first issue was pretty much the same issue as the first Fantagraphics one. The Fantagraphics one just had more material in it.
Now, how did you get connected with Fantagraphics? Like, how did they see it?
We were reading, subscribing to the Comics Journal, and we kind of liked how they were kind of nasty. You know, they were kind of like, you know, didn't like comics, and, you know, we shared a lot of the feelings. And Gilbert thought, well, we don't know what to do with this comic. We don't know how to distribute it, how to get it out there. So he thought he would send a copy to the Comics Journal to get reviewed. And even if they hated it, at least it was some kind of advertising, you know. And Groth loved it and wrote us a letter and said, can we publish this? Yeah.
And then from there, 50 magazine size issues.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, the change from magazine to smaller size.
So that was, okay, when we did 50 issues, we were just totally burned out, and the continuity was just building up so big that we couldn't do an issue without having to explain who was married to who and this and that. And it was, and we were really fried because we had been going 15 years straight. And even if we weren't that fast, it was still, you know, we still had never stopped. And we just fried, and we were planning on 20 years of Love and Rockets. But then when 50 was coming up, Gilbert suggested, well, why don't we cut it off at 50? And they said, okay, that's fine. And, you know, we ended it, and then we started doing our solo projects. I was doing Penny Century, he was doing New Love and some other things. And we noticed the sales were going nowhere. And every time we'd go into a comic store, and if the person there knew us, they would say, you know, people keep asking where Love and Rockets is. We say, oh, don't you show them Penny Century? They go, yeah, but they want Love and Rockets.
It's the same thing.
But in the last issue, they weren't reading Love and Rockets. And so we decided, we go, well, why don't we just start up again? We're going to do the same material anyway. It's not that big a compromise. And just for our own sanity, we just decided to make a tiny change, and that was to go comic size, just to make it feel different. You know, it may sound silly, but any little change would have just freed us, you know.
Well, it didn't change the way you approached doing the book. I mean, comics, did it?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you that well.
Oh, sorry. It didn't approach the way you did the stories, did it? The change
in
size.
Well, it didn't, in the fact that I didn't have much room in panels anymore. And that's beginning to bug me. You know, I was used to the wider panel to fit more people in it and to fit more drawing, and now I have to rearrange the page to make everything fit. You know, that's why and a lot of stories have gone to that four-tier instead of three-tier thing, and they're just really small panels, you know, that I can to deal with. But I like that, I don't know, that movie screen, you know, that letterbox shape. That just is a really good way to work. And so what Gilbert and I are discussing is we're coming up to our 20th issue. We're thinking of starting 21 with a magazine shape, but just a shorter, a smaller, like a flat comic size, you know. We're talking about that. I mean, we haven't even mentioned that to Fantagraphics, so you guys know before they do.
Well, I hope they're not listening.
Flat comic size?
What's that?
What do you mean by flat comic size?
Like a comic size, but just shorter, squattier.
Kind of like, trying to think of the right series like that. There's stuff like that. I know what.
Oh.
It's just keeping the same dimensions as the magazine size, but smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. It's there's really no sense to go magazine size because it'll get lost in the racks. You know. God, listen to me. I'm almost 50, so I gotta think about, you know, how this thing is gonna sell. I remember the days when I never used to even worry about that stuff.
Just do the story and go out there. Jaime Hernandez. We will be back with him in a second. I'm doing the total PBS thing. Breaking the interview. It's a great interview. I'm a huge fan of his work. This is a CITR funding drive. We are needing money to fix up the place, get new gear, have more great programs like this where we have interviews with Jaime Hernandez, creator of Love and Rockets and the Locust Storyline. Next week, I'll be talking to his brother Gilbert Hernandez, and that'll be a live interview. And I'm really excited about it. I think I've been reading his more recent stuff over the past couple of weeks just to refresh myself, get myself going, to have good questions, good strong questions, and I think it's going to be a great interview. For the funding drive, if you want to donate money and get tons of free, cool, well, comics for donating money, and because you're listening to Inksteads, you get extra stuff beyond what people normally get for giving stuff. Like, normally you get, like, a CD and a Friends of CITR card that gives you discounts in all sorts of great places. As well, you get an awesome book. And I'm not talking like, oh, look, I got copies of Captain America for everyone. Yay! It's like, I would say, the best comics out there right now. Like Kevin Huizenga, the Hernandez Bros, Chester Brown, Gabrielle Bell. Just awesome work. Give us a call at 604-822-8648. CITR 101.9 FM. A couple of quick announcements also. Don't forget, 604-822-1242. Lucas Soy sent me an email. He's a really gorgeous pen and ink drawer. Really great eye for detail. He's doing an art show that's opening tonight at 190 West 3rd at 8 p.m. I think I might go check it out. It's a couple blocks from where I live, so if I don't, I'm a lazy bastard. And as most of my friends will tell me, I am a lazy bastard. You should go down and check it out. This Saturday is the Comic Jam at the Jolly Alderman. Every third Saturday of every month, we get drunk and draw comics. Well, I draw one panel that disgusts everyone else in the room, but it's all fun anyways. www.citr.ca. Give us a call, 822-8648, for free stuff if you give us money. We need the money. Make the place better. Make facilities better. Make us have more diversity in programming, yada, yada, yada. It's great. CITR is a great station. One reason to give money, so you don't have to listen to Justin Timberlake. You never have to worry about hearing that here. You just hear quality programming with great music. Up next is going to be Rhymes and Reasons. Now I'm going to finish this interview. 822-8648. One thing that we ask a lot is what supplies artists use. And sometimes people think we're weird for asking, but when I talk to people about the interviews, that's one of their favorite parts is finding out what you use.
The tools.
Okay. Well, the paper, I use Bristol Bullard. I use the 500, the Strathmore 500 series, because it's the top of the line, and it's it helps because the ink I use, which I'll get to next, it bleeds for some reason on any grade lower than that. And I don't know if it's because I use a nib, which I'm getting to. You know, I use a super black ink stuff. And ever since I've been doing this comic, I've been using a nib, which is the Hunt 22. And it's only because I remember buying, when I wanted to learn to ink way back before the comic, there was this speedball set of ink holder and a number of nibs. And that was the only Crowquill style nib in it. And I started using that. And I just got comfortable with it. And when we started the comic, I just saw no reason to change. By the sixth issue, Gilbert had turned to brush, but I just was very comfortable with the nib because I kind of use them till they're worn down and they kind of are easy to make thick and thin lines, you know, some that look like brush.
How long do they last you?
I've had some that have lasted 10 issues.
Oh.
There's some that I keep, I still keep, I don't use, but I keep in case I want to do a big, thicker line drawing or something like that. Some of them are, just get worn down where they're impossible to use after a while. But yeah, it's just, you know, that's it. Is there anything else?
About tools?
Yeah.
No, I think that was just... It's curious. People like to know, like, what kind of pens people use in paper. One thing I'm wondering about is...
Wait a minute. I couldn't hear.
Sorry. A lot of people, like, wonder about the pens and paper, so that was great. One thing I was wondering about is covers. There's so many covers that aren't collected in these voluminous collections. Is there any plan to do, like, some kind of book of Love and Rockets covers?
No, but that's a good idea. I never thought of that. You mean like in color and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it seems such a shame that, you know, a lot of work is put into making that cover. And then with everything being recollected, the big thing is pushing trade paperbacks, And then you have all these great comics that are losing, you know, those great covers. I mean, Cerebus is another example where you have all these covers that just kind of fall to the wayside.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when we first started collecting the stuff, we did have the covers in color. There was a little section.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess for economical reasons, it just kind of went away. And yeah. I just haven't thought about that till you mentioned it.
I like to see it. I would buy it. I would buy a book of covers.
I would.
In the Locust collection, the big, huge one, Flies on the Ceiling wasn't part of that collection.
Yeah, when we started that, it was going to be everything I did. And then we found out that it would just be way too big. So it was narrowed down to just the Maggie Hopi stories. And that kind of bummed me out because I thought some of my best stuff is non-Maggie Hopi.
Well, that's something, talking to some local... you know, fellow comic enthusiasts, is Flies on the Ceiling, I think, was one of the strongest storylines in the book.
Yeah,
and it just felt like it needed to be a part of it.
Well, maybe I'm hoping there'll be another book or something.
Will that be the plan with the manga size collections, to be a complete collection of all the stories?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's kind of be the different volumes will have different things and not everything in order as they were in the comic, but it will be all complete. I mean, I can't leave anything out this time.
That's excellent. I look forward to that. You have created such a huge universe of characters. How far ahead do you plot out what's going to happen with Maggie and Hopi and friends?
The only way I do that is I think like, okay, one of these days Maggie has to get married, or one of these days Maggie's gonna get old. So I picture 80 years old. What comes in between that is not so planned out. You know, it's I kind of do Maggie like I do her life as my life goes along. Kind of like I get older, she gets older. I try to figure out what interests her, where she's going to be or where she wants to be, you know, stuff like that. That's easier with Maggie. With someone like Hopi, Hopi's more of a mystery, and that's on purpose. I tried to create Hopi as somebody you knew once in your life, and then you didn't know her for like 10 years, and then she came back. And so Hopi's future is a lot more mysterious. I don't know where she's going to end up, because people I have known like her, I've rarely seen where they've ended up. You know.
You see little spatterings of person here and there.
What's that?
You just see little spatterings of a person appearing here and there and then disappear from the life.
Yeah, I try to treat a lot of people like just people I know. You know, characters come and they go, and I know they're alive somewhere, or maybe they're not alive, and one day we'll find out that they're not. You know, just it's kind of that person who lives down your street. You know, you kind of, God, I wonder whatever happened to that person. You know, and next time you see them, they've had a whole life apart. You know, and had some big adventure or something. You know, that's how I try to treat the characters.
And that is, I find kind of neat, is like I read about the collections, and then I'll read a collection like, oh, I remember when this person appeared way back when. And it's just neat. It's like, do you kind of, when you're doing it, you're like, why don't I throw this guy in and see what he's going to do with everyone?
Yeah. I love doing that. I just don't, I'm trying really hard not to make it formula. I mean, it would be very easy to just live, to just do this comic for the next 10 years of just going back to issue 2 and going, hey, here's a guy I haven't used in a while. You know? So I'm trying to be very careful where it doesn't seem formula.
Now, are there any plans to do non-Locust work?
Yeah, there's always plans. My ideas don't come as fast as, say, Gilbert's. Doing this comic for so long, I rely on the characters writing their own stories. So someone like Maggie or Hopi, they'll write a whole story just because I know who they are, and that keeps me doing this on a regular basis. Every once in a while, I'll come up with an actual story that doesn't have to have the characters in it, and those are usually the ones people like the most. But like, say, Flies on the Ceiling. That one took 10 years to write, because it started out as one thing, just from an idea that Izzy's brother Speedy said. He said, then she went to Mexico, and then she came back the way she is, you know, and no one knows what happened there. So I took that one balloon, and I just thought about it for years and years, and I go, okay, I'm going to do Izzy in Mexico now, you know, and it was a totally different story. And then it was going to be this big 10-part epic, and then it turned into this 15-page story. You know. So to answer your question, I need the characters to write themselves, because the ideas don't come as easily to me as someone else.
Have you ever tried to write the characters into a situation where they would refuse to go?
Yeah, and it's hard, because it's they kind of tell me where they're going. You know, so sometimes we have to fight about it, kind of thing. Yeah, but you know what? If I put a character in a place they don't want to go, their personality will write the outcome of the story. You know, they'll the type of person they are, how they would react in a situation. You know, so it always becomes their story in the end. You know, I try to say, okay, I'm going to do this with you. I'm going this way. And then they bring me back because of who they are.
Pulling me back in.
Yeah.
I think we have about enough here. Thank you very much for coming and joining us on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And I think there's new Love and Rockets coming out tomorrow, I think.
It's in the stores here.
Okay. Maybe it came out last week.
I don't think so.
I haven't spent enough time at the comic store lately, I guess.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming on the show with us.
Oh, thank you, guys.
And I'm going to send you an email later to find out some music requests. So think about 4 songs for us to play.
Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to do that. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Have a good day. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Bye. Bye-bye.
That was Jaime Hernandez, or Jaime, creator of Love and Rockets, with his brother Gilbert, with the Locust storyline. Awesome stuff. He's one of those legends in comics that people talk about, like alternative legends.
I remember the first time Love and Rockets came out, and I knew that something special had happened, and this was the start of something.
And it's still going, and it's excellent. I think he's continuously growing in his storytelling, and it's always developing new, interesting stuff. So I am totally hyped on seeing any new stuff, and I think it's all great. And I think you all should check it out.